This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Welcome everyone to this second last session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas. My name is Robert Fidian. I teach English at Flinders University, but I'm also chair of the Program Advisory Committee for the Festival of Ideas. So I'm very glad to be reaching this point in such good order. I'm going to do what I always do at this session, which is thank the audience for your attendance and your intelligent contributions. It's one of the most gratifying things about this festival, the way people engage. Anyway, so that's me. Our session today with Chris Sarah and Andrew Plastow is about particularly Indigenous education. I acknowledge that today we're gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders past and present. Housekeeping at the beginning, please switch your phone to silent during the session. Please feel free to do the Twitter and Instagram stuff at the addresses that you've been told about several times. No unauthorised recordings permitted of this session. Permitted during the session, they are being audio recorded by Radio Adelaide for broadcast and future podcasts, so they'll be available in due course. And we're going to operate today as much as possible at the end of the festival, at the end of a Sunday, as much as possible as a conversation between these two wonderful educators, Chris Sarah and Andrew Plastow, we've already rehearsed. We met for a cup of coffee in the hour before this, and if we just taped that, you'd be a very happy audience, I can assure you. So we're really just going to be trying to replicate what happened in the Art Gallery Cafe from 2 o'clock. To introduce these men, talking about this crucial topic about how to bring people on and forward, particularly Indigenous people. I'm not in the habit of reading out the program notes, but the program notes say it so perfectly well for Chris that I'm going to do this. Dr. Chris Sarah is a world-class educationalist. His strong and smart philosophy led to dramatic improvements in educational outcomes at the Cherbourg State School in Queensland. He now leads the Stronger, Smarter Institute, which is transforming Indigenous education with positive messages of high expectations, quality relationships and community engagement in schools. Led by Chris, the Institute's programs are having a significant impact on students, educators and communities in schools across Australia, and that is what we all dream of. Andrew Plastow has been living with similar issues as an active educator for the last 17 years, and for the last 10 of those, he's been principal of Alberton Primary School, and he'll tell us a bit about that, I think, in his presentation, just a story there. In Adelaide, he is certainly a local hero of innovation and inclusion. Today's discussion will focus properly and urgently on how to address Indigenous disadvantage in education, but disadvantage is the wrong mindset to enter with. I wouldn't want any of us either to slip into the pleasing illusion that this is only an Indigenous issue, without much relevance beyond their community. The kids I see arriving at Flinders University from different backgrounds, with different expectations and even different senses of self, tells me that this is a very important story for all of us. So we're going to ask Chris to talk for just a couple of minutes, and then Andrew, and then we're going to... And then they're going to keep talking, but they're going to talk to each other and we'll just gently overhear them.
Just like that. Thanks very much, Robert. And thanks, everybody, for coming along to listen in. And I suppose it's okay for me to encourage people to just jump, like if they have a question, to just put your hand up because... Great. And lots of questions is a good thing. So if you want to jump into the conversation as well, then feel more than free. I'm going to start just by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land also. It's great pleasure to be back in Adelaide and on Kaurna country. My story is interesting. And when you listen to the bios, I was pleased to hear that you, Andrew, you're described as innovative and creative and things like that. When I was at Cherbourg School as the principal, I was often described as controversial, and it used to niggle me. I want the tag that you had. No, I'm just kidding. It doesn't worry me that much. But what niggled me was that the only thing controversial about what we were doing was having high expectations of Aboriginal children, because at the time it was probably conventional kind of thinking, just to go through the motions and endure kind of chronic failure and disengagement of Aboriginal kids, like somehow that was normal. But when you interrupt a status quo, whether it's in Aboriginal education or in any place, people get upset, and I suppose that's why it became described as such. So earlier I was chatting with Andrew, and it's remarkable some of the similarities that we encounter when you try to assert a high expectations agenda and the pursuit of excellence and the pursuit of a high expectations relationship with Aboriginal children. It's interesting, and you do encounter conflict. You do end up fighting with teachers' unions and those sort of things, and I was struck by the similarities and the challenges. But Andrew, maybe you might articulate some of those same sorts of challenges, and let's kind of wonder about our points of the same. So from your perspective, what were the things that made it difficult at the start? You heard me talk about interrupting the status quo, but I'd be fascinated, and I'm sure the audience would be fascinated about what were the difficult parts for you when you set about trying to assert a different agenda, a high expectations agenda.
Thanks, Chris. I also would like to pay my respects to the Kaurna people and thank them for allowing us to meet today on country. But particularly want to pay my respect to the elders of the future, who are many of whom are students at Alberton Primary School. And this heading of defying expectations is certainly something that they continue to do every day of their lives. I also just want to respond to the notion of controversial, because I got to write that bit about innovative. If it came from somebody in Central Office of Department of Education, controversial may be a word that's used for me too.
I'll get you now.
So I know where you're coming from there.
I'm going to write dashing next time.
And very appropriate it'll be.
Oh, thank you.
Before I sort of respond to that too, I guess I just wanted to describe a little bit about where I come from or where I was coming from when I walked into Alberton Primary School, and start by acknowledging that today is actually the 25th anniversary of the death of my younger brother. And my younger brother was someone who died just before his 16th birthday, and throughout his high schooling, what it pretty much looked like was, because he was a fairly spirited fella, first day of school, came home with a few lines to write. Second day of school, came home with a few more because he hadn't done his homework because he had spent the night before doing lines, and that was pretty much what his schooling looked like. And myself, I won't be breaking into song today because music is just something that I won't go near. And a large part of that, I guess, is the sense that it was something that I feel was stolen from me by schooling. And so for me, coming into Alberton Primary School, I had this real sense of schooling can quite often steal from children as much as it can grow in them. And I guess came in with a lot of pondering about that. So when I came to Alberton Primary School, it was certainly a situation I was describing. It had gone through an interesting history over the last 10 years prior to me getting there. A principal had made this decision when the school had about a number of about 400-odd to try and make it an Aboriginal focus school, because at that time, as it is now, it had a reasonably large number of Aboriginal students. Pretty much overnight, the school went from 400 to 150. Students, which was a fairly telling story in itself about how far Australia had come in the couple hundred years leading up to that. But following that point, the school then had a fair bit of work to do to rebuild itself, and in doing so had quite a change, a fairly dramatic change of leadership over a number of years. So came into a school where students were not achieving their potential. And they had plenty of potential, as do our kids now, and really talented staff who themselves weren't necessarily working as successfully as they wanted to be, partly because they were in a survive every day type of a mode of thinking. And so you had students and staff coming to school each day and quite often not coming to school. And that was both teachers and students, coming to school each day and feeling like they were preparing for battle in that day. And so it was something that just wasn't a way that anybody really wanted to live, and we needed to really get a sense of how to move that forward.
Mm. So if you had to kind of... I know I'm pretty sure I've got to what I reckon the pillars or the kind of cornerstones of the stronger, smarter philosophy are, and I'll describe them in a moment, but if you were to say what is the core of your kind of philosophical approach at the school, how would you describe that? Or maybe another way to answer the question is, when you've got a new staff member who's been appointed to your school, let us in on the conversation with them when you're talking about the school and what's expected of them.
Yeah, I won't do to you like I do to them. It's usually a pretty long slog for them. I guess for us it's really about a partnership in learning. And we talk about building the school on two pillars, one of them being student choice and the other one student voice. And I think for children, this is something that the United Nations sort of came up with, you know, the need for this quite some time ago, but we've really struggled to put into practice. And I guess for us it really is about the children actually taking some responsibility for themselves and us allowing them, us allowing them to. And so that notion of expectation is really about, you know, it's your learning, it's not mine. You need to be able to develop that passion. What we've got to do is try and stay out of your way in the search for that, and that's part of that role for.
So student choice and student voice. I like that. That's very cool. And for us, it's strong and when we're running the school, it's strong and smart. And so the conversations with teachers who were appointed to the school, or even when kids would turn up and parents wanting to enroll their children at the school, we'd say, look, the two things we talk about here is being strong and being smart. The strong part is about what's in here, and a strong and positive sense of your cultural identity. So in this school, we will do whatever it takes to nurture within you and get you to understand that being Aboriginal is something to be proud of, not something to be ashamed of. And it was kind of a sign of the times that, and you know, I've just watched young black kids right across the country, quite explicitly colluding with a negative stereotypical view of being Aboriginal, thinking that they were reinforcing their sense of Aboriginal identity. And we had to take them on and explicitly say, do you know something? You think, if you think that spraying graffiti or swearing at the teacher or throwing things around the room, you think that's makes you more Aboriginal? In fact, it doesn't. All you're reinforcing is a negative stereotype that's been held out for you. Now let's have a conversation about the truth about being Aboriginal. So that was the strong smart, and then there was the smart thing, and it was smart enough up here so that we could mix it in any modern society in any part of the world. And the two things go hand in hand, and one enhances the other. Another kind of popular and sort of unsophisticated view, I suppose, is that you can't have one without the other. And I've watched this in some of the more remote places around Australia where there is a view that people don't want Aboriginal children to be educated because somehow they lose their sense of identity. And I just find that a pretty rubbish kind of notion because it's kind of flawed. And in some ways I see it as an excuse for those teachers to not have to put the work in to get those kind of academic results up to where they should be. But it certainly is possible to build kids to be strong in their sense of positive cultural identity and to be smart enough to mix it with any other child from any other part of Australia or the world. And I know that because I've watched it with my own eyes.
Mm. Mm. It's interesting, Chris, you talk about that notion of pride and about the graffiti side of things. One of the things that we are working with a number of our Aboriginal children is that notion of the gangster. Mm. And having to, in this contemporary setting, having to work with our Aboriginal children to get them to understand that that's not their background, it's not their culture. And while there may be comparisons of colour of skin and so forth, the reality is they're two distinct histories and two distinct sort of issues that they've come through in terms of African Americans.
Yeah. It used to drive me nuts at Sherbrooke when your kids, somebody put a camera up and these kids are coming like, I said, put them hands down, you're not in America now.
Yeah.
You're Aboriginal children, not African Americans or something like that.
So what do you do then? What do you do with them to take them?
Well, I remember very well the days in Sherbrooke. We'd sit on school assembly and we'd run it in the library and you'd have photos of old people in traditional gear and photos of old role models and other Aboriginal people who'd walked before us. And I would say, look, sometimes you'd grab the picture and say, have a look into their eyes and do they look like somebody who's going to run amok in the community or do they look fierce and proud? This is what the truth is, Have a look at this and now you make the choice. Do you want to be strong and smart like this person or do you want to be something else? It's as simple as that. You make the choice and if you make this choice, then I'm with you. If you make that choice, there'll be consequences.
Now, I think we all have a bit of a theory in this room about what Alberton's like, and I'm sure we need to be cured of some of those theories. But, Chris, could you just tell us a bit about Cherbourg?
Yeah, Cherbourg's an old mission. It's in southeast Queensland. You know where Cairns is? Yeah, it's nowhere near Cairns. nowhere near Mossman. Now, again. If you flew into Brisbane, you'd drive north for 2 hours and then you'd drive directly west for 1 hour. So it's quite close to Brisbane. It's an old mission and it's strange because you've got a little township called Mergen that's got about 5,000 people and then a little township of Cherbourg, which is 5 kilometres away, about 3,000 people. And it literally was a place where you had to get permission to come and go from. And it's, even today, we run our leadership programs out of Cherbourg. And there are people who've grown up in Mergen, have a look and they hear the stories of some of the old people and they're just floored, they're just emotionally wrecked because they say, we didn't even realise that people were being treated in this way. So it's an ex kind of mission and it's had its complexities. You described to me the hardest, most complex kind of levels of dysfunctionality from any community in Australia. And that's kind of what Cherbourg was like,
He
has, yeah, he was there while I... The question was, has Archie Roach been there? He certainly was. He came with Ruby a long time ago. But it's a place that was kind of established where people rounded up from as far north as Cooktown, as far west as Quilpie, Cunnamulla, all of those places, and northern parts of New South Wales, and just plonked in Cherbourg and had to get permission to come and go. And there's a kind of historical and sociological legacy all of the fallout from that kind of being systemically kind of disempowered and told that being Aboriginal means you're inferior and somehow you've got to pretend that you're white and being sent off to work in for farmers or as domestic hands or whatever, and not ever giving your wages, but having that taken so that you're kind of the levels of poverty that exist were nurtured by systematic government policy. You know, that the poverty, and in fact it's the same right across Australia, you know, the chronic poverty that we see can clearly be argued that it's been engineered by government policy right across Australia, where people were sent off to work but not ever given their wages and not allowed to benefit from the profits of their land. So Cherbourg's that kind of place. The school itself was 250 kids, mostly Aboriginal. There were two non-Indigenous young girls, and I'm happy to talk about them later on because they were fascinating. But it was a pretty tough kind of. We had to work hard, and we had to sweat blood along the way. But you know, I started there in August '98. I left in 2005. But attendance went from 62% to 94%, which is pretty good in any school. And you know, something, we didn't cut anybody's welfare payments to make that happen. I'll say that again. We didn't cut anybody's welfare payments. We just made it a school that kids wanted to turn up to and parents would want to buy into. And it's interesting, you know, I watch some of the government thinking that the answer now is this direct instruction that they talk about as a form of pedagogy, which has been written off by the best educators some 40 years ago, but now they think that this is going to be the solution in Aboriginal schools. But the thing about a program like direct instruction, forget the fact that it's written by some old guy in America and it's a product off the shelf. It's a kind of a pedagogical approach that sort of takes you back to the 1940s and 50s. So it's very strange. And what I like about our time at Cherbourg is the kind of curriculum framework and pedagogical framework that we used at Cherbourg School was the same one that was being used at Brisbane Grammar. We couldn't say the same for these approaches that today's government is talking up.
Chris, if I can just jump in there too with with that that notion of direct instruction, a lot of the... I guess the background to that is this notion of back to the basics. And I'd heard it put just beautifully in terms of that notion of back to the basics, that while we're focusing on that, creative and wise people have created robots that will do the basics. So to sort of be thinking about that back to basics approach is just so... it's absolutely antiquated in its approach, and really doesn't give children madness. That opportunity to build on to wisdom.
Madness, yeah. And yeah. I can see why people are attracted to it, because it kind of looks like, and this is what governments will say, though I was at a meeting where Nigel Scullion was talking and he was saying, you know, there's a generation who are quite literate. And, you know, that's kind of true, but only literate to the extent that they were purposeful as domestics or farmhands. There was nothing, it was not, you could not say it was an education about nurturing power in Aboriginal people. It was in many ways still about keeping people contained. So at Cherbourg they had the Van Leer program where kids would do this program, which is quite similar. And it wouldn't, what they were finding was kids would leave Cherbourg grade 7 to go to high school, leaving to do grade 8, but finding out that their literacy numeracy standards were only at about grade 4, they're going to find the same thing with this program. It's a very poor approach.
So Andrew, Chris has talked a bit about what he did at Cherbourg. You got us to the point of telling us about what you've been doing at Alberton. Could you just tell us a bit what's happened?
And I guess a big basis from the philosophy of at Alberton is to provide opportunity, and B to build on that notion of again of pride in who children are, and I guess specifically with our Aboriginal students. And so, following on that concept of student voice, we have a children's parliament at Alberton Primary School. And one of the ministries is our Aboriginal Nations Ministry. In fact, it was their predecessor, what we called our Nunga Executive, that worked with some fourth-year social work students to develop the Children's Parliament in the first place. But that That group is about demonstrating, A, providing opportunity for leadership, and B, providing our Aboriginal students with modelling of leadership, and I guess countering that whole notion that is so often put out there in the media, which comes from a deficit approach, and giving students that understanding that no, we actually don't have gaps to close. We're quite capable and talented as we stand. Thank you very much. But the other, I guess, part of that last year, we have a Prime Minister, and last year for the first time since establishing our parliament, we had a year six that was elected. Caused all sorts of controversy and so forth that it wasn't a year seven. But she was an Aboriginal, it was an Aboriginal girl. And what was wonderful about
it... She didn't knife
it,
somebody through the night, did she? Metaphorically.
Nothing like that. Yeah. But it was wonderful that the controversy was about her year level and not about her culture and background, which I think is, synonymous with where the school has come. But certainly from a societal point of view, we've got a lot further to travel in terms of following that. One of the big things for us, we set up a structure in our school which basically took away the whole notion of students of a certain year level having to be achieving a particular set of skills. It was acknowledging the fact that the year of manufacture should not necessarily determine the education that you get. And so we have a reception to year seven groupings in our school. What we found particularly for our Aboriginal students was there was the opportunity for kinship groups to actually be together and to work from a supportive point of view, because it works very, very successfully in many of our Aboriginal homes in terms of how the groups support each other and build on their knowledge and wisdom together. And so it was able to bring that home environment into the school environment, and from there we've actually found a lot of positivity and success.
And my guess is, Andrew, that kind of restructuring, if you like, is always anchored by the pursuit of good outcomes and good teaching and learning outcomes, that's never sacrificed. Because I've watched some schools make that same mistake, thinking they're setting up a sexy model, but it's kind of more for the purposes of babysitting kids and a way of saying, oh, we're doing this, which is great, but actually literacy and numeracy outcomes, they sort of fall by the wayside, when it should be that kind of restructuring in the interest of the pursuit of better literacy, numeracy and more global, holistic sort of education outcomes rather than instead of them.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting though, Chris, we focus less time in terms of minutes than many schools focusing on English and maths development. I'll use the words English and maths rather than literacy and numeracy, because literacy and numeracy are really, they're happening every minute of the day. But less time on English and maths, but making it very intentional and very purposeful. Mm. And in doing so, what we've found is that our students are improving in their English and maths results, in that beautiful tool called MapPlan, than they were when we spent hours upon hours focusing on those those subjects. So, we spend a fair bit of time actually on just keeping children whole around that academic.
Yeah, that's always you're right to pull me up on that kind of narrative about literacy, numeracy, and I get the kind of apprehension in the room about NAPLAN. I wrote a book just recently and I talked about NAPLAN from my perspective. It might be interesting to share. And there was an analogy I made. Now, I'm going to venture into risky territory because I'm talking about a football analogy, but I'm talking about the real football, rugby league. And some of you might be less cultured, so you might have no idea who Mal Meninga is. Yeah. Ever heard of him?
Shortest political career in history.
So Mal Meninga is the coach, the rugby league coach of the Queensland team. And I don't know, if you're a New South Wales fan, it hurts to know that Queensland are winning 8-0 in the series so far. But anyway, I should move on, I think. So they've got this winning formula. I speak to Mel Meninger a little bit. I said, what's your secret? What's the secret of your success in terms of building a team? And he says, look, Chris, I tell my boys when they run on the field, don't worry about the scoreboard. Just give me your best performance. Give me 100%, 110% if you can. And if you can do that, the scoreboard will take care of itself. So just worry about what you're doing on the field. And if we walk off and we lose, it doesn't matter, as long as I know you've given your best. And it struck me, you know, that this is the perfect analogy for NAPLAN. NAPLAN for teachers is really the scoreboard. And if we can get our colleagues to understand that, that it's kind of there, and I think it's there for an important reason, as long as politicians don't overread or misuse its purpose. But it's kind of like a scoreboard that's there. And if as teachers and school principals and teacher aides, we focus on being the best that we can be on the field or in the classroom and make that the sacred space where we can be as superb and as excellent as we can be in the relationships, the scoreboard's going to take care of itself, and we shouldn't be too bothered about that. In fact, the more we can be less focused on that, the better off we'll all be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Just picking up on the football analogy.
Did I get you to all to agree that rugby league makes more sense than rugby? Sorry, Andrew.
While a very keen Maroon supporter myself, I'll just sort of take the football analogy into the AFL for a little bit. And obviously, you know, the results of the team are crucially important. But within that, there are individuals who are celebrated for their performances as well. And although the Gold Coast Suns didn't do particularly well still on from the team side of things, Gary Ablett was acknowledged as an individual at the highest level with the Brownlow medal this year. One of the things that we sort of do very well in society and in media is to celebrate Gary's efforts. What we don't do in then taking it to Aboriginal children in the education sector is to celebrate the individual efforts. We only ever look at the team score. And certainly, if you look statistically at comparative scores, Aboriginal children are statistically, consistently achieving lower in NAPLAN than non-Aboriginal students. But within that team story, there are a lot of individuals who are doing fantastically well, even in that particular NAPLAN genre. And that's not... I don't believe that's being picked up by the media, and therefore it's not necessarily being picked up in society, is that there are an incredible amount of talented, capable, wise, skillful Aboriginal children. Because that isn't picked up on the whole scale, that there are those individuals, the modelling that is then put forward to our Aboriginal students is the modelling of you're always behind. Now, that makes the effort of those that are striving to get up to the top that bit more difficult, but it also makes it more difficult for those who have achieved at that higher level, because there's a pulling down effect, a cultural pulling down effect to sort of, you know, get into the graffiti, you know, going back to that graffiti sort of headset again.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's you know, an example to furnish your analogy is, you know, you look at NAPLAN scores or you look at the school scores that occur as a result of the yardsticks that we use to measure, it will tell you that a six-year-old in some remote parts of Aboriginal Australia are very poor at literacy, yet he's a kid who might be speaking three or four languages before he speaks English or she speaks English. And teachers will grapple with that, and they might just assume that, well, this kid is a very poor performer. But, man, you can be a six-year-old who can talk three or four languages, and that's something pretty exciting to work with, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so we've got to be mindful of all of those kinds of yardsticks that we use.
And can I just add the one thing, one of the many things that irritates me about Australian culture is the extent to which the bulk of us can only speak one language, that we're locked in one language, and it is intellectually and I think ethically constraining.
See.
So, yeah, Aboriginal people start ahead on that count, See. Absolutely, in my view.
Sì, è vero, quando parla così, sì. That's some Italian there as well. So. Sorry. Why don't we see what the audience has to ask us? Eh?
Yeah, I reckon it's about time. The microphone's over there, so if people can move in a elegant manner and make an orderly queue.
Oh. It's the, what is it, survival of the fittest. So you pushed that young guy out of the way. Well done.
In a year when we had a female prime minister who was undermined and treated abysmally by the media, I wondered, you know, you had a female prime minister in your primary school at Alberton. It sounded like that wasn't an issue. Was she the first? And what is the pride taught about being female in school and the awareness of misogyny all around us? And how does that work in your primary school and yours in Cherbourg too? Yeah.
In fact, our prime ministers have all been female, which is an interesting thing. I was we've got the Governor's Leadership Foundation having their education session at our school on Tuesday, and my Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister and my Minister of Education are hosting the session, and I noticed that they're all female. And I thought, oh, this probably paints an interesting picture, but when I looked at it across our ministries, we've actually got more males as ministers in our parliament, but the top jobs are always taken by girls. So it's been an interesting thing, but to completely untailored, and so that's been quite an interesting realisation, I suppose, that it did get me having a look back, and I thought, oh yes, we've had the female leadership throughout. What I sort of get from that is the fact that yes, the top jobs have been our females, but there have been more males in the ministers' positions suggests that gender isn't necessarily a factor in terms of leadership within the school, and it's certainly something that we don't try to focus too much on. You know, it's a little bit like Chris was talking about, focus less on it, and I guess keep out of the way, and nature will actually take care of itself a little bit.
I haven't got much to add to the discussion, but I will say I'm just in the middle of reading that, I forget her name, The Stalking of Julia Gillard, and it's quite fascinating and quite toxic, really, just to reflect on the behaviour of people in and around that. But as an educator, and as one who probably feels like I don't have anything to prove in education, I'm comfortable about saying that she will go down as one of the greatest education reformers in our country. And it was nice to work in an era where the Prime Minister had such a passionate interest in education and knew what she was talking about. And it was so tragic to see her undermined from every angle in the way that she was done. So, yeah, that's all I'll say.
First of all, I'd like to say, I'd like to commend both of you, Andrew and Chris, for the work that you've done, because it's actually quite amazing. From the point of view of an educator who works in detention centres, I've got a million questions, but I'll try and narrow it down. We don't often talk about Indigenous students who work in suburbia, who come from suburbia. And this is one of the problems that we have, from where I'm coming from, is that a lot of these kids, when you were talking about culture and where they're coming from, is that a lot of these kids don't really have any interest in their culture, and they don't have any interest in finding out where they're coming from. And I'm really torn between this because I find that it is important that they, you know, have some sort of knowledge about their roots. But, and the organisations that come in and work with us push that line that they should not learn about their culture. But to them, their culture is, again, unfortunately, like you said, this is the gangster American culture, which in some ways is extremely distressing because the only relationship that they have is probably skin colour, and that's by a long bow. But what do you do in a situation like that? Because we often talk about the kids who are really on the outside, the Indigenous kids that are on the outside, but we don't often talk about suburban Indigenous students.
Thank you.
Well, I'm happy to jump in on that. This comes from no robust research whatsoever. This is just purely experiential observation. But what I've certainly found is our Aboriginals, got to be careful with generalisms, but more often than not, our Aboriginal students who are most successful in the Western education system know themselves better, know who they are, where they're from, who their family is. They have that real understanding of their cultural links. So to sort of know who one is and where they come from, more often than not, actually equates to better success in Western education. One of the things I think where we have some issues is this whole notion of Aboriginal culture. Now, there are obvious reasons why we talk about Aboriginality as a collective, but there are certainly many different Aboriginal nations and many clans, and what we try to do is overlay culture that does not necessarily belong to Aboriginal kids. You know, dot painting is the classic. If I ever see another dot painting during Aboriginal Cultural Awareness Week, I will go dotty. you know, it's not from here. It's not from here. So why are we trying to force that on a Kaurna kid that this is your culture? It's not their culture.
Yeah, look, I'm still, because of your young, fit guy getting knocked out of the way by a 42-year-old lady at the middle there. just thing. But Andrew's gone straight to the core of the question, and it's what I was thinking about when you're asking about, when you're wondering about questions of culture, that is the, you know, what do we describe it as? And you know, this kind of, this perception of being Aboriginal that's being held out as the negative stereotypical view is pretty horrific, and that is backed up by my own empirical research to sort of reinforce that. So you kind of get why kids wouldn't want to subscribe to that perception, because it's pretty awful. But then if you can understand, get at the essence and the truth of what that sense of culture is, and understand that it's not so much the, it's not always that kind of really exotic sort of stuff, but it's as simple as what are the feelings going on inside here for me? What are my family connections to the people around me? What are the kind of parts of the landscape that I walk upon that are significant to me and my family and my history? What are those things? You know, and for me, when I'm an 8-year-old kid in Bundaberg, my hometown, fishing in the, chucking a line in the Burnett River, and I look across and I see Paddy's Island, and I know that some 150 years earlier, that's where there was a massacre that occurred there. And there's a kind of significance about that. That's not overly exotic or anything like that, but it's something about knowing and appreciating that I carry the blood and our kids carry the blood of the very first Australians. And when we touch the land, we're the only Australians that can say that we walk the land of our ancestors, for thousands of years. And I don't say that to alienate white Australians. I just say that as a point that's worth understanding, you know, and to try to bring white Australians back in. To that kind of something special and something magical about that, whilst you won't share that kind of tens of thousands of years history, you can get to embrace that, but you can only embrace that by embracing Aboriginal people in a relationship that's respectful. And if we can recalibrate the relationship and understand the essence of the truth of being Aboriginal and what our sense of culture is, we can lay the platform for a much more honourable kind of relationship into the future for white Australians, but for also for some of the young kids that you're working with. Does that make sense?
Could I just say,
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob.
My name's Sissy. Just to top on what your question was in relation to, you seem to have a dilemma about culture and about where the people are within the institution. Is that what you're trying to say? Are you trying to bring out more culture?
No. What it is that some of the kids that I work with are from suburbia.
I understand, yes. And you're saying they're more in the remote areas that are entering into the institution. Is that what you're saying?
No, suburbia, so like in the suburbs, like Elizabeth and places like that.
Okay.
So these kids haven't had an upbringing that's got, you know, where they can associate themselves with any indigenous culture.
They have it here. But what they're most comfortable at is being in the... having their food every day, a shelter over their head, and being, you know, someone's there for them. Basically, there's two different parallels, I see, if that's a word, because I am of an Aboriginal descent, mother and father, with influences of European, you know, but I've even worked in the institutions for 8 years in probation and parole, so... I think that what I find is that once the belly is full and they're comfortable, you know, culture still stays here. It's embedded here because we grow up with it. Both my parents were from taken away, stolen generation, and they grew up, my father particularly, went to war, came back with the authoritarian attitude. You know, you've got to do right. The white way is the white way. So there was 10 of us, and I was eldest of 10. So you know, I found that was a dilemma for me, living this white life in this black existence. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So you'll find that in anywhere. As long as our people here are loved and brought up with family in the culture itself, in language, in dreaming, in song and dance, you'll find it will never go away.
Thanks for that. Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you. No, beautiful.
Can I build on? Can I build on to that too, in terms of that always in the heart? I'm a Koori person, but not necessarily brought up with that knowledge in my early years, And what I've found, being working in an environment with a lot of Aboriginal people, and certainly with a lot of Aboriginal staff who have been supportive of my journey, I guess, is that the understanding that cultural knowledge is a real thing, that there are things that I do instinctively that are from my Aboriginal heritage, that is not something that was necessarily taught. Because we didn't know, and so, you know, my parents as well haven't necessarily taught those things. It's in the heart, and it's an instinctive component. Mm-hmm.
Oh, who knows?
I'm not aware of the science behind it.
If I can extend the conversation, it is possible also that, I mean, one of the things that's obvious, you might be sitting there thinking, well, aren't they supposed to learn their kind of Aboriginal cultural stuff at home or whatever? And that's true, but there's also scope to learn about it at school and have it reinforced at school as well, because your sense of cultural identity is not something you take off and you leave at the school gate and then you pick it up on the way home, because if schools do that, then that kind of undermines a kid's sense of cultural identity, when instead we should be bringing it in, and we should be bringing Vietnamese kids should bring their sense of cultural identity, and it should be finding a valid place in the curriculum and the learning experiences that go on. And so those are important things to understand. But if you were running a school and I was enrolling my kids into your school, and you asked me which was more important, or what do I want them to get a stronger sense of cultural, nurturing their cultural identity, or do I want them to get good kind of academic outcomes, and my response is pretty simple. I'll have both, thank you. Yeah, and it's my human right to expect both.
Absolutely. And I think it doesn't end at school. We're all working on our cultural identity. I know I am, and it's never been that hard for me, obviously. Madam.
I'm fortunate enough to be a volunteer at Alberton Primary School, and I can tell you it's palpable. I'm a lay volunteer, and I don't work with Indigenous children, but it is palpable for all of the children in that school. I have a question for both of you. Defying expectations in terms of parental engagement and raising parental engagement for Aboriginal children, and the role of Aboriginal leaders in your schools other than the leaders among your children?
Yeah, it's a really great question, Lena. Thanks for that. it's interesting for us. It's certainly it's a struggle in terms, again, of getting a volume of Aboriginal parents into our school. But where we have Aboriginal parents and caregivers involved in the school, the leadership that has come from a few has been immense. And we had the real fortune, going back about 6 years ago, where the chairperson of our governing council was an Aboriginal man, and it was probably a time, I feel, that as a school we made our greatest progress in terms of support. I guess the wraparound supports, the other part of what Chris was just talking about, but also academically. So it's certainly an important area for us to keep on investing in. Again, I think for me, I would rather have a few strong leaders than us coming up with inauthentic, catchy programs or whatever to involve parents. It would be great to have many parents in that leadership role, but I'd prefer for an authentic few than a few that we're sort of bringing in through some latest catchy federal funded initiative, I suppose.
Yeah, look, I think the questions around Aboriginal leadership are pretty obvious, you know, and obviously if you had more parents engaged in...
The queue's back there.
If you had more parents engaged in... actively engaged in schooling, then things would be a lot easier. But it's never impossible, you know. One of the things that frustrates me a lot is just how easy we can put the blame on parents for not engaging, and how easy we can sit back and say, oh, well, the parents don't value education. When the real question is, what is it that we have that's worth valuing in our school? And if they're not valuing what we have to offer, what is it that we need to change? Because after all, we're the ones paid to be in this circumstance. So, you know, if you run a restaurant and people are not turning up to your restaurant, you don't say, oh, well, they don't value what we've got to offer. You have a look at the menu and you change things around, or you change the decor or whatever. So I've always encouraged people to reflect inward. And I know that when we went to Cherbourg, parents were disengaged because, frankly, we had nothing worth the education that existed there. It wasn't worth valuing. I wouldn't have sent my kids there if I was in that community. And so we had to re-engage. But we could have sat back and said, the parents don't value education. But instead we looked at what we controlled, and we understood very well that we weren't in the community to transform the whole community. We were in the community to deliver a quality school inside the school gate. And once we did that, we found that parents became more involved then because they liked what they had to offer. So that's the way. You know, it's focusing on the things that you do control, but not ever forgetting what we're paid to do. I was at a school in the Northern Territory visiting, doing a review of school, and I had the principal and the two deputies sitting down with me saying, we've got fantastic programs in here and the teachers are so great and they're working really hard. The problem is the kids and the parents don't want to get involved with what we're doing. To which I responded, okay, so how great can these programs be then if kids don't want to turn up and be a part of them? And I think it was she got a bit of a shock when she heard that, because I think it's one of those lines that they just get so used to trundling out and people just back off and say, oh, it's very difficult for you here. So their response was this. They said, oh, well, you don't really understand what it's like here, because there's a lot of domestic violence and there's a lot of sexual abuse and there's a lot of alcoholism and a lot of gambling that goes on in this community. So they're the sorts of things that we have to put up with. To which I responded in this way. I said, okay, so you're telling me that you have this air-conditioned school with great teachers and great programs, yet the kids in this community are choosing to locate themselves amongst sexual abuse and domestic violence and alcoholism and gambling. If they're making the choice to locate themselves amongst that circumstance, then what the hell does that say about the quality of your school? Because I think that's what the real question is. They didn't like my response very much, and I got up and walked out after that. But that's what it's about, you know. It's being honest enough to reflect inwards and saying, what are the things that we really control?
Now, it's the last thing I want to do, but we're going to have to hurry up a bit at this stage. A minute or two back, I got told it was 5 minutes. I do teach English, so I'm not very good at counting. We might go a little bit over, but can we please accelerate the questions and the answers?
Yes. Do you want to do all the questions at once? Would that be an idea?
No, we'll just see how we go.
All right, sorry, I'll just sit
in. Mine's not really a question. I just wanted your response to the Australian curriculum.
So, in three words.
I think that was to you, Robert. Oh, look, there's always going to be some... I think, Andrew, you'll probably agree with me, but when you run schools, by the time it gets inside the school gate, you kind of... Those things are necessarily to provide a framework, but the sacred spot in any education system is in the classrooms where the teacher stares the children in the face. So you'll always have those things, and there'll always be their limitations, but as long as we can make that place magical, that's what I think we should be more concerned about.
I could not add to that. It was beautifully put. Thank you, Chris.
Hear, hear. Sir.
Just want to say good day to Mr. Sarah. He knows my brother better than me. Jim Stanley's my name. I'm from Sherberg Aboriginal Settlement. That's where I was born.
It's lovely to see
you. And I was one of eight that the education system up there experimented on, like guinea pigs and what have you, to see if we can cope with high and further education. There was eight of us. Four went on to Mergen. But when we had to do our homework, I had to take my homework home to Nana. Nana couldn't read or write. This was me. But I've walked on. I run away from Sherbeck. I had to get a permit, go 4 miles away to do my shopping. If I was found outside those mission boundaries after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, put in a lock-up on Sherbeck Aboriginal Settlement. So that's my experience, but I'm just coming from an Aboriginal studies in schools. I'm called all over South Australia to go and talk to them about Aboriginal studies. And our children, they have lost their identity. But what I work with them is I've got a yarning group for boys. Auntie Nellie Egan has got a yarning group for girls. And I work with both. We're at Christie's Beach High School. Mentor, that's my name, and I mentor these children and give them back to who you are, where you come from, who's your mum, who's your dad, who's your grandfather. I said, I know your grandfather's in that. Let's get up and go work together and be proud of your identity, be proud of your Aboriginality, and let's move on. That's where Aboriginal studies come from. But for leadership, I'm one. They call me Uncle Jim, whether you're Aboriginal or not. And that's the respect that I've got in schools that I've worked with. And I work at Christie's Beach High School on an hourly paid officer from in the mornings up until 12 o'clock. Then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I'm at Seaford 6 to 12 school, working with disabled children. And one of those, or three of those disabled children, are my grandchildren. Now I've got three boys, three girls, 35 grandchildren, and 22 great-grandchildren.
Uncle, can I just respond to that? And I guess this is where I keep on harping back, is that I would say where Uncle talked about our children have lost their culture, I would again go back and say some. Some have, and some have it in a fragmented way, but there are some that are clearly connected to their culture.
Thank you. This will be our last question, please.
Yeah, the first one is models. Two that come to mind is Dr. Yotha Yindi, and the other one is Malala. Do the Aboriginal kids know about these people? And the second question is, not a question, question statement. It's very clear that it's true of any kids, white or black or whoever, anywhere over the world, is to be able to think, learn, and enjoy education and be educated, they need good health. In this country, the worst people who are in bad health are the Indigenous people. They have a problem. We need to look at their health before we can really look at education.
just in terms of models, for kids at Alberton, it's Auntie Rosie, it's Uncle Johnny, it's Colin, it's Nana Dot, it's Auntie Veronica, and I could go on. They are the homes that our kids come from, and they're the champions of our kids. I don't think that our kids necessarily always need to have a footballer of any code or a musician as their only role models. You know, we've got some fantastic role models within our own community that for me are the gems. So that's the first thing I'd say. And the other thing I'd say is that it's a bit of chicken or the egg. Health is often... you know, good health often stems from a strong education, and so it's a bit like Chris had said before, it's not about one or the other, it's about both have to be looked at the same time.
Yeah, I wouldn't be stacking them up one after the other. And look, we're a sophisticated and wealthy enough country, we should be able to do both at the same time. And in fact, it's interesting when you think of, the point you made earlier about most Aboriginal kids being in schools where they're less than 10% of the population, that is the case right across the country. And in fact, if every Aboriginal child in a remote school got an A+ for reading or writing or whatever, we still wouldn't have closed this gap that everyone talks about because of the sheer volume of Aboriginal kids that are in other schools. So it's worth understanding that and putting it into context. But what's worth also noting in terms of the remote context is that there is quite a chronic lag. The kids in remote schools are a long way behind. But you know what? There's probably 250 remote schools in Australia. That's a bite-sized chunk. You know, that probably means somewhere in our country finding 250 Top Gun school leaders and less than 1,000 Top Gun teachers. Surely we could do that, you know. That's a bite-sized chunk and we could really rip into that. It's doable.
Well, thank you very much. Chris, you said something about making the classroom a magic place, and I'm sure we all agree that this, for the last hour, has been a magic place listening to you two fine men talk about these important things. So on behalf of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and the audience, we thank you very much. Thank you.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.